From the Creekside Room here in Holden Village, this is a lecture and discussion by Ingrid Christiansen, single story number one. So let's move in and listen to Ingrid as she leads the lecture and discussion.
This is Ingrid Christiansen, and I'm doing a session on Carol Bly's story, The Last of the Gold Star Mothers. So I'm going to read you the story. I did lay the main characters out here because I always lose track of them when I'm hearing a story for the first time. I think it's easier if you can see them laid out a little bit. So the main character is Mary Grabbing, who is characterized by Carol Bly as a divorcee. Carol Bly gives titles to everybody in the story, which I think is one of the interesting things, because the title of the story is the title of a person in the story, the Gold Star Mother. And the Gold Star Mother is Mrs. Lorraine Grabbing. Then there are four people in the sheriff's office: Leroy Besky, Merle, Dwayne, and Christy Marie. There's Mrs. Blatke, who is a widow. There's Fran Paddock, who is a man, a businessman, and a school friend of Mary's. Cordell Grabbing, who is the ex-husband of Mary and the son of Lorraine. Mr. Dolly, who's a building manager, and Greg Z. Hansen, who's the kid on the bike. Most of the people. I think there are a lot of interesting things that Carol Bly, she's so complicated as a writer. She does a lot of interesting things in this short story. One of the things that I realized when I was reading it through for about the third time is that she does two views of many subjects. One of them is two views of France. First of all, she has one person sort of declaiming about France, and then later on somebody else says something about France with a differing opinion. Two views of singleness. There's the main character is single because of divorce, another one is single because of death. There's another person who is single by choice. Two views of mental illness, and in fact, that's sort of a big one in this story, the mental illness, because that mental illness is tied to suicide. And we sort of wonder, she tells us what the attitude of the community is toward this, toward mental illness and toward suicide. There's even two views of cheerfulness, and of course of religion. There's two different ways of talking about basements, and I think the basement theme is sort of important in this story. Of course, there's two different views of the roles of men and of women. The whole business and money and work stuff is important. The main character's work, and what is called work, and what is called hobby, and what is called play. And then there's a lot about play. Toys, hobbies, imagination, play. And there are at least two stories within stories in this story. So I like stories within stories, and I'm always interested when they happen, and I always think about why they're happening. So you might ask yourself those questions. I'd like you to think about, as you're listening, what is this story about? Is it about the main character, Mary? Is it about her depression or lack of depression or her possible suicide? Is it about single parenting? Is it about the meaning of life? If so, what is the meaning of life? So those are sort of the broad stroke questions that occur to me when I read this story. Well, I don't have to tell you what to think. I'll just let you think your thoughts, and then we'll talk about it when I'm done. I am going to omit a few paragraphs that I think it won't hurt the story for me to omit, because the story is a little too long for me to read and us to discuss. The Last of the Gold Star Mothers. I don't even know what a Gold Star Mother is the other thing, but I take it it's some phenomena in small towns that has to do with World War II.
It's that they lost a
child.
Loss of a child. And that's another very interesting part about this story. Who died, and did he really die, and so why is she a Gold Star Mother?
On a windless early evening in October, almost the best time of day of the best time of year in Minnesota, no one was standing on the escarpment path in Rachel River County Park, where you can look out over the fir forests toward Lake Superior and the distant glow of lights in West Duluth. The park was deserted, in fact. No one was leaning on the old WPA-built wall to watch the Rachel River falling perfectly from one black stone to the next, eventually to find its way down the escarpment to the place where it joins the St. Louis River. People in Rachel River keep busy, and sometimes they seem too distracted to see things. No one, for instance, had noticed a battered safe, which sat in the bed of the stream in the park. It had been stolen from a Union 76 gas station a month earlier in a celebrated local crime. The thief had been found out and caught, but the safe, torch cut open and dumped right in the middle of Rachel River, still lay among the rocks, and the slight spindly water fell on it without variance. On this particular evening, a Tuesday, most of the regular people, that is not the Duluth Air Base personnel and their wives, who don't count, but the regulars, were down at the Rachel River VFW Lounge. Drinks, for once, were at half price in honor of Mr. and Mrs. Kevin Olaug's son, Kurt. Everyone explained to everyone else that Kurt Olaug had been in the service in some native place called Angola or Angola. No one knew in what branch of the service, but anyway, now he was back and drinks were at half price. The local radio news lady, a 33-year-old divorcee named Mary Grabbing, sat in the best corner booth of the VFW lounge. She was celebrating something secretly. From the beginning, she had intended to spend the whole evening there, so she had the foresight to prop herself up in the right angle between the back of the booth and the wall. By her elbow, someone had scratched on the wall a suggestion to the IRS about what it could do with itself. Mary had arranged a smile on her face quite a while ago. Now it was safely fixed there, and she herself was safely fixed. And although she was immensely drunk, she was not so drunk as the others, which meant she counted as dead sober. When Mary Grabbing was sober, her face was too decided and twitchy to look good with the large plain earrings she always wore. She thought she was generally too grim looking, and her earrings looked too cheerful at the edges of her face. Now that she was drunk, though, and wearing a red dress, her face felt hot and rosy. Her smile stayed stuck on, and she knew that the earrings, a new pair, especially cheap, not from Bagley's in Duluth, but a product of the Ben Franklin store in Rachel River, looked fine. She was not beautiful, but she was all right. She was crowded into the booth with seven local people whose familiar faces were getting blurred. One was Leroy Besky, the sheriff. Each person had a hand round his glass, and their fingers looked silvery in the nightclub lighting. The fingers were numb and stiff with drink, as silvery and thick as fingers in the empty suits of armor in city museums. No one is shallow and vulgar forever. Sooner or later, the whole species likes to be profound. Now, after everyone had pleased everyone else by adding comments to the IRS graffitio, a moment came when Leroy Besky was profound. The others could take it from him, the sheriff explained, that all of culture, all of American culture, and that went for the Europeans too, they weren't any better, was getting more and more slovenly and cowardly and uniquely filthy. The sheriff repeated the last phrase clearly, as sonorous as John Donne. Yes, he said, uniquely filthy. In 1946, he had stood on the Boulevard Saint-Germain with his buddies, and he could assure them that the French, too, like everyone else, even the French with their fancy Paris, were uniquely filthy. Everyone in the booth marveled at every remark. 100 philosophies brimmed wonderfully in their heads. That was Tuesday night. At 9:30 the next morning, Wednesday, the dispatcher's room in the Rachel River Jail was softened by sunlight that slanted through the barred horizontal windows. Christy Marie, who covered the radio, was filling out court forms at her desk under the two radio speakers. A deputy named Duane Sorkelson sat at another desk, idly making throws into the blotter from a dice cup. The sheriff himself leaned by one of the windows, watching for the other deputy, Merle Schaefer, to come in. Everything was as usual, but the team was a little nervous this morning because Christy Marie and Duane knew that Leroy Besky was going to put the scare into Merle whenever he showed up. Now and then, while they waited, a message came crackling in on the radio. Then the sheriff straightened up. Merle had appeared outside the jail, where he paused at the concrete steps and gave a languid smile to a little boy named Greg Z. Hansen, whose face shone up at him. Poor kid, the sheriff thought. Greg Z. Hansen's dad sold him out for the bottle, and his mother sold out everybody in town. When she went down the aisles in the Super Value, she even sold out her baby as he sat in the cart, explaining his faults to everyone in the produce section. And now, the sheriff thought, even this cop that Greg Z. admired wasn't much good. Merle came in the jailhouse door, and Greg Z. stood one-legged on the concrete, with his other knee thrown over the seat of his bike as he watched him go. The Duluth Herald bag lay caved in his bike basket. Turn on the radio to KTRW so we can get Rachel River program when it comes on, the sheriff said to Christy Marie. Turn it low until she comes on, though. Merle came in, raising a hand to his glossy, thick hair. He was having an affair with a woman named Verona McIver in Floodwood, and whenever he looked in the mirror of his cop car, he saw a man involved with a woman, and with women generally. A gigantic man, hopelessly wrapped in physical satisfactions, his own desires, women's desire for him. When he walked, there was a lunge about his walking, as if he carried several women on his shoulders, clinging. They clung all about him, and his walk supported the great weight of them. All right, Merle, the sheriff said. He's going to bust me for seeing Verona, Merle thought, instantly noticing that no one in the room would look at him. I don't want no counterculture job selling auto parts to farmers, he thought. I want this job. I want the uniform. His quick glance out the window showed him that that little kid, Greg Z. Hansen, was still standing there waiting to look at him, Merle. Okay, Merle, the sheriff said, we live in one lousy, slovenly time of United States history, but there is one lousy, slovenly thing that's not going to happen again in Rachel River County, okay? Okay. Labor Day, you were in charge of the Gold Star Mother's car in the parade, right? Okay. The parade forms in front of the Vision Avenue apartments where you pick up the Gold Star Mother, the only one we got left. And then everyone marches and drives to the cemetery where they have the doings. I got two complaints on you. First, you stuffed our one remaining Gold Star Mother into the car so mean she got bruised. She brought a charge. But that isn't all. When you got to the cemetery, what did you do but get out and turn off the ignition, which means that the air conditioning went off. You left the windows rolled up and you let the Gold Star Mother in there. Mrs. Lorraine Grabbing is not a young woman. It was 105 Fahrenheit. She could have died in there. I would like you to know that she is a symbol of our whole national honor. Without her, we wouldn't be the kind of country we are today. Now, if we're not going to have any respect anymore, it'll be the end of the Gold Star Mother program completely. Merle was so relieved it was not about this woman that he was seeing in Floodwood that he had to work to keep from smiling. He would not lose his job over stuffing a Gold Star Mother into a Ford. He said, yes, sir, in a tone he had heard on a police program on TV. And there's another thing, the sheriff said. You regard yourself as this big hand with the ladies. No, sir, Merle said with great dignity. Well, since you're such a great man with the ladies, the sheriff went on, I've got something you can do today. You know her. It's Mrs. Blatke, that widow of that guy committed suicide. Well, I want you to find her, and then you make it clear to her she doesn't call the police anymore. I know she's upset. I know her husband robbed the Union 76 station, and we caught him, and I know he killed himself. I took that refresher course on police psychology. And I know she blames herself for something, but that doesn't mean she can go around town getting in fights with everyone all over Rachel River and then calling the police, okay? And I don't want you to tell her mean. Tell her nice, but firm, and don't make a pass at her. You've got to be kidding, Merle shouted. Make a pass at Mrs. Blackie? Listen, nobody would serve as a pallbearer at her husband's funeral, and who volunteers but me? And I got the five others, too. Yes, the sheriff said, and then later that night you called her up, and word is, you made a pass at her. Christy Marie waved one hand at them and turned off the volume on the speakers. And now the radio announcer's voice said, "We go to Mary Grabbing in Rachel River for the Rachel River County News. Good morning, Mary." "Good morning, Bert," said Mary. Her voice sounded a little husky because it was carried by telephone from her house at the south end of Rachel River to the Duluth studio and then the 11 miles back again by radio. "Today is the feast of St. Maurus," Mary said. She did not sound very hungover. "Tishy's got a nice voice," the sheriff said. "I'm glad she took that job, since she had to get a job. Is it true she's got nerves?" "I don't know," said Christy Marie. "I heard that too. But she always seems real cheerful." "Although today is actually the Feast of St. Maurus, we haven't got any reliable information about his life. And for a very special reason, I'd like to tell you instead about St. Alban," the radio said. "But she shouldn't have religion on the radio," Christy Marie said. "Last time they had religion on, we had 7 phone calls from Lutherans saying they didn't want that Catholic crap on the radio. And 9 calls from Catholics saying they wanted equal time if they were going to have that kind of Lutheran crap on." "Speaking of religion," the sheriff said, "do you remember when that occult group cut up all those cattle over toward Purim?" "I remember that," Christy Marie said. "It is too bad that St. Alban isn't better known," Mary was saying over the radio, "because we have a man in Rachel River with a birthday today who is here, alive, able to celebrate that birthday just because of people in France who did what St. Alban did long before that. St. Alban was the first martyr in the British Isles. During some persecutions, Roman soldiers were going around picking up Christians to torture them, and a legionnaire came to Alban's door and said, 'We are looking for a certain escaped Christian.' Well, this Christian was hiding in Alban's attic, and Alban had traded clothes with him." "Yes, I know," Alban said. "I am the one you are looking for." "You don't look like him," the soldier said. Alban said, "Look at my clothes. Look at me. I'm the one you want." The Roman soldier was stubborn, however, and said, "Somehow you don't look like the right man." But then he thought, "I've got to bring somebody in, and it's getting late." So finally he said, "All right, all right." Or whatever the Latin or Celtic for "all right, all right" is. And he took in Alban, and they killed him. During World War II, Mary's radio voice went on, underground forces in occupied Europe faced the same sort of thing Alban faced. It must have been terrifying to have someone knock at night and explain he was an American flyer or an underground intelligence agent, and could you hide him? You always knew that if the Germans caught you, you would be tortured for information and then likely killed. Well, Milan Hansen of Rachel River, who gets our radio birthday greetings today, is alive because somebody was brave enough to risk self and family to hide him 34 years ago and help him reach the channel. And speaking of help, what better help could you expect to have? Could you expect than have your next winter's furnace costs cut in half? That's right, cut right in half. You couldn't do better than to plan now, because if fall is here, winter can't be far behind. And Merv Scholasted is carrying a line of wood-burning stoves that can make hundreds of dollars of savings for you. When the program was over, Mary replaced the telephone receiver in its cradle, turned off the power box, and unplugged the cassette player she used for taping town council notices. The Duluth station had set up this radio telephone hookup for her in her own basement. To Mary, the program meant a tiny, unfailing income, with that marvelous virtue that she could be home when her children, Will and Molly, got home from school every day. The other end of the basement was reserved for her toy-making business. Between the radio program and the toy-making, Mary spent many hours every day in the cool, brightly lighted basement. The old cellar shelves were soft and grainy with rot. The previous renter, an AFDC mother, had left loops of rusty Kerr-top canning rings there, but Mary had scrubbed off the space she needed and spread out the tools of her trade there. A dish of chuck keys, a small saber saw, 2 sizes of nail sets, all her lacquers, a miter box, her power saws, and sander. The place reminded one that generations of women had stored home canning there and had filled and emptied laundry tubs into the sump hole. There was an aura of domestic bravery and domestic squalor about the place still. But now the basement had some glint and bustle, too, which came from Mary's shiny, imposingly modern radio equipment on the desk. her squared-off drawings on the steel table, and the bright orange electrical drop cords curling everywhere. In the middle of the room, and in the space where a washing machine had been before the men had recently come and repossessed it, there stood several half-finished castles and Norman keeps and a three-story dollhouse, all smelling beautifully of AC ply. On school day afternoons, the children would burst into the house above her. The old farmhouse shuddered when they struck the door with their knuckles and books. Mary would climb the basement stairs, dazedly, and in the shabby living room, she and Will and Molly would drink cocoa, sitting in front of a print of two sailing ships over the mantel. The ships were heavily square-rigged. They tore along in the lunging, green, tremendously deep Atlantic. The children loved to say, "Just think what would happen if a man fell overboard into the sea." And Mary usually assured them solemnly, "It must have been nearly impossible in those days to put her about to pick up anyone." Sometimes Mary explained as much about the rigging as she understood. They all drank their cocoa and speculated silently about a man overboard treading water in the deep sea and watching his ship grow smaller as it sailed away and left him. Then, on most days, the children went outdoors to play, and Mary went into the kitchen. Little by little, the hours of silent work in the basement would sift from her mind, and until soon her supper-making seemed perfectly practical, perfectly pleasant, in the way that hobbies are pleasant when you get your mind off your life work. If they were having pastry for dinner, she gave it her attention and got it right. But just now, in October, Will and Molly were spending a week at Pike Lake with their father, Cordell. As Mary worked on a bookcase she was building as a surprise for them, she kept track of the quarter hours as she waited for the time, arranged with Cordell, when she would telephone and talk to them. The calling hour was agreed on for midday on Wednesday, since school would be closed then for a teacher's in-service. Across from where Mary sat, there stood old red-painted steel table on which she kept her drawings of toys and her general accounts. In her childhood in Duluth, there had been metal furniture in two places in her house, in the maid's room in the basement and out in the shaded north-facing terrace. Every spring, the terrace furniture was repainted by the hired man and then set out on the stone flagging. All summer, it never seemed to lose its chill. Mary had been expected to take part in her mother's teas out there, when she had to listen to her mother's friends and their little quarrels about books. They sat on the painted metal in their silk dresses and responded to one another in flurries. "Oh, but Julia," they cried out, "can you really say that with impunity?" Mary sometimes found herself staring down past the terrace ferns into the window of the maid's room in the basement. She could see the two iron beds there. Her own basement, Mary sometimes felt now, was not unlike the maid's room. Sitting by the unfinished bookcase, Mary fitted new paper into her sander. At the same time, she was estimating her income for the current year. The bookcase was to have a lever on one side, which opened a secret vertical shaft that would run from the top to the bottom of the case at its back. On the opposite side, the left, there would be a fishing reel fastened to the case, which was to operate a miniature dumb waiter inside the secret shaft. She meant to make a tiny velvet-covered chest to fit in the dumb waiter, in which the children could keep their treasures, whatever they liked. She was not building this bookcase to be sold. And for this reason, her face was mobile, nervous, and sometimes smiling as she worked. Her facial tic was not so bad as it was sometimes. The other toys standing about, the apartment building dollhouses, the 16th century half-timbered dollhouses, the castles, and the puppet show, were all parts of her business. They sold at prices from $65 to $400 each. Before she became self-supporting, she had never imagined that one tends to do major economic calculations over and over again in one's head, as if the figures might improve with repetition. She knew that her total intake this past year would be $11,300, but she kept refiguring it. Now she added things up again while she carefully drilled a hole for the fishing reel cable to run through. The 20-minute radio program 5 days a week brought her $500 a month, which was $6,000 a year. If she got orders for four large castles at $350 each, that would be $1,400, which made a total so far of $7,400. 10 medium-sized castles would bring in $1,500 more, making a total of $8,900. In the first year after he had left her, Cordell sent her 11 out of the 12 agreed-upon monthly child support payments. In the second year, he sent 10. Now she figured he would send an average of, say, 8 payments per year for another year or so. At $150 per child, that brought the total to $11,300. It was not really enough. She worked at the children's bookcase for an hour, getting used to the pleasure and irritations of the task. She liked to work fast, watching her hands touching things gently. She disliked her habit of sometimes carrying a pencil or nails in her mouth. Presently, she went over to the radio table and telephoned a farm equipment dealer named Merv Scholested to suggest that she write him an ad for his Potts manure movers, which she could alternate with the ad she now read over the radio for his Schweiss wood-burning furnace. She eased him off the telephone in time to call the children at the prearranged time. She listened to the telephone ring 20 times. Then she decided she might have misdialed, so she called again and let it ring 10 more. After a while, she went upstairs to wash her face, which looked awful. She was a person whose eyes puffed up quickly. She gathered her sheets and clothes from a basket and drove to the other end of town to the laundromat. She was very sorry to find a woman she knew named Mrs. Blatke in the laundromat, sorting through a pile of unclaimed clothing. "Why, hello," said Mrs. Blatke in a false tone. Mrs. Blatke's voice was not perfectly respectful because although her husband had been caught knocking over the Union 76 station and then had felt so bad he couldn't support her and the kids that he had committed suicide, at least he had been a faithful husband to her. And this Mary Graving might be a big shot with a big shot job running the radio program from Rachel River and selling fancy toys to big shots in Duluth. But the fact was, Mrs. Blackie's husband had died, and Mrs. Graving's husband had just up and left her. Mrs. Blatke, therefore, did not move over enough to let Mary Graving get her laundry bag between the folding table and the line of machines. Mary, on her side, knew that Mrs. Blatke stole clothing from people's dryer loads if they were not watching. So she did not say, "Excuse me," when her laundry bag hit Mrs. Blatke's leg with a sharp edge of the cheer box inside the bag during the hit. Then Mary thought of something she must have forgotten in her car, and she went back out and came back in and squeezed by Mrs. Blatke again and hit her legs all over again. "Funny, a lady like you having to use a laundromat," Mrs. Blatke said after a while. "I've heard if you miss one payment on a washing machine, they will repossess it these days. But I wouldn't know. I was never one to buy stuff I couldn't afford and then have it repossessed. Mary looked thoughtfully out the window. "I doubt if that cop is coming to look for me," she said aloud. "I never have had cops coming after me in a laundromat." "Maybe he's got something to say just to you. I could step outside." Mrs. Blatke jerked around and peered out the steamed window. "That's a no good cop," she said warmly. "He isn't much," Mary said. They gave each other a quick look, and then Mrs. Blatke said, actually in a kindly tone, "He did volunteer to be a pallbearer at my poor hubby's funeral, though, and no one else would because, I know," Mary said, "and I'm sorry about your husband, too." Outside in the autumn sunshine, the policeman leaned against his car, idly smoothing his glossy black hair. Mary didn't wait to dry her clothes, but took them wet from the machine and got into her car and drove away from the laundromat. In the rearview mirror, she saw the policeman, whose name she now remembered, Merle, amble into the building. She had an appointment with a man called Fran Paddock for 3 o'clock at Ye Old 61, a kind of roadhouse dinner club, which he and a partner, who did some sort of cooking for the place, had recently bought. Now they were going to keep it open in the afternoon, too, in order to sell quality tourist items. Mary walked into the orange varnished log building. In the dining room, there was one table over by the window that didn't have chairs placed on top of it. A youngish man with sandy hair came out of the kitchen, opening his palms in an apologetic gesture. "I'm Fran's partner," he said. "I can't shake hands. I'm baking, but at least I set up some place for you two to sit." They both looked out the window next to the table. "I'm feeding bears out there," he said. "This time of year, sometimes 3 or 4 come lumbering up." "Bears, schmears," a cheerful voice said behind them. It was Fran. Long ago, he and Mary had gone to school together in Duluth. Looking at him now in the shadowy restaurant, Mary could see that he had changed less than she had in the past 15 years. He still had the undeniably comely looks and extroverted expression that had never caught her interest when she was a girl. The basis of their friendship was not their few dances together at the Northland Country Club in the summers, but their nerveless and violently competitive dinghy racing at the Duluth Yacht Club on Lake Superior. They had both won a lot of races, and Fran had probably beaten her a few more times than she had beaten him. The Coast Guard had had to bring them in out of trouble more times than all the other Duluth sailors put together. "I see you've introduced yourselves," Fran said now with his old grace. "Mary's an old friend and a great sailor, too." Mary sat down. Fran's partner hovered for a moment, and he and Mary exchanged a glance. They hadn't introduced themselves at all, and now Fran was still talking about sailing in the old days. Mary understood that he was probably being extra gregarious in order to assure her that even if they were meeting on business, he did not discount his old association with her. He was trying to lessen the tension of one person being there to sell the other one something, telling her that he knew she was not trading on an old acquaintance for commercial use, or that if she was, he was not offended. "I still say there's nowhere you get that sense of reality that you do sailing," he said. "Hiking way out over the side, close to the water like that, you're touching down on reality. But why should I tell that to you, of all people?" "I haven't sailed in years now," Mary said with a smile. She noticed that Fran immediately looked away when she said this, the way rich people sometimes do when they are afraid that a friend is about to explain that he has had to retrench. Fran's partner wandered back into his kitchen, and Mary and Fran began to talk business. From time to time, as they discussed orders and discounts, she heard the baker slapping dough in the kitchen. "There won't be any plastics," Fran said. "Strictly good things. What we're dealing with here is the guilty father. The children have been with him all weekend, say, and now it's Sunday afternoon late, and they've been cross, and that's made him cross, and he got sharp with them, but he doesn't want to deliver them back to their mother with them remembering that, so he stops in at Ye Old 61 and buys them these very good toys. It'll work, Mary. When the kids get home, the mother turns over the toys, looking at the labels, checking to see if they're strictly airport. But Ye Old 61 toys won't be airport, so Dad will end up way ahead. Okay, let's see what you have, Mary. One of my real resources is what you are." She showed him drawings and descriptions and Polaroid pictures of her work. She saw he could tell that the things she had made were really first class, especially the French townhouse with its blue-green mansard roof and the tiny signs painted on the smudgy cream outside the wall. And then it says something in French, which I can't read. Ending in 1881. Fran laughed. "We need a tiny wooden toy dog out there peeing on that lamppost," he said. "It would be a great selling point. The French are great on peeing." The moment Fran said this, Mary knew he was going to cheat her clean. In the next few minutes, he did make an unfair consignment offer for her major toys and said he would not handle the small ones. "What you really need are stuffed animals made with art fabrics," he said, "or, you know, that quilted sculpture. Can you come up with a line like that?" "Kids hate those art toys," Mary said. "Yes, but they are very counterculture looking, and that's in," Fran said. He glanced out the window. "Hey, one of your bears has come in," he shouted toward the kitchen. The baker hurried in and bent over their table to look out the window. His arms, sanded all over with whole wheat flour, were very near Mary's face. Mary and Fran and the baker watched a huge bear moving things around outside, lifting garbage, studying it. "They're like dancers compared to how dogs move," offered the baker. After a while, Mary got up. "I'll get back to you on the consignments," she said to Fran. "Remember, Mary," he said, "this is big. The guilty fathers, the classy toys, the grimy, whining kids wanting something. And don't forget to glue a dog onto the French apartment building. And how about a trademark like La Vraie Chose? That could be your mark, Mary, La Vraie Chose on all your toys. It's a terrific idea." She smiled. He wasn't mistaken. It was a sound idea. His shop was a sound idea. As she drove home, she felt so low-spirited that she forgot she was secretly celebrating last night and today and was not going to be sad. Back in Rachel River, she had one more appointment. She drove to the Vision Avenue Senior Citizens Apartments, where Mr. Dolly, the manager, said it was nice of her to come on time because it made him just so nervous when people weren't punctual. He expected punctuality of himself, he said. He expected it of others. The problem is Lorraine, your mother-in-law, he said. Or should I still call her your mother-in-law? I guess she still is my mother-in-law, Mary told him. It's been 5 months since the rent was paid, Mr. Dolly said, holding his palms upward. Now I have discussed with Mrs. Graving, Lorraine, would she go on welfare? This is a practical move, you know, and there's no disgrace in it. She told me her son Cordell would pay the rent. I said, well, he hasn't paid it for 5 months now. Then she said I was lying and trying to cheat an old woman out of the rent, and she would call Cordell, and he would drive over from Pike Lake and show me a thing or two. So I said, well, you might as well call him, because if he comes in, I can ask him in person, will he pay the rent or not? Then she grabs her gold star flag off the window and shakes it at me and says, you see this gold star? If you treat me wrong, there's a lot of people who are going to remember what this stands for, and they won't like it. I told her, I am not treating her wrong. I am trying to get the rent paid is all. I'll go up, Mary said. Her mother-in-law, Lorraine Graving, was crouched by the window, lifting the gold star flag up so she could see out. She was stooped but full of spring. Ooh, did you see that? The old lady said. My, but there's a fight going on down there. Look at that. That grown woman grabbing that boy's bike and threw it right down on the sidewalk. Crazy. And she's left her car parked right out in the middle of the street. She turned and looked at Mary. Yeah, I know why you're here, she said. Now you listen to me. I'm not letting that Dolly push me around. And I'm not going to let you push me around. You never gave Cordell the least bit of love and support. I always helped him, and he always said, Mama, I'm going to take care of you when you are old. Well, now I'm old, and he is taking care of me. He was always an affectionate boy, Cordell was. I can't say the same for his brother, Emmett. Emmett's the boy I lost. I don't suppose you ever met Emmett. During the war, you know how people went around showing you all the letters they got from their sons with those APO numbers and reading the letters to you, too? Well, we never got any from Emmett, not a one. He seemed to be just as glad to be away from home. We was running 40 head of cattle in those days, and they never took both boys off a farm. One would get drafted, one would stay home. So I said to Emmett right out, Emmett, you better be the one to go because you're always so restless anyway, driving around fast cars and all. I told him a good joke that I thought would make him have a sense of humor about it. I told him, join the Navy and see the world. Mrs. Graving paused to let Mary laugh, but Mary was hungover and had laughed at jokes all night at the VFW lounge, and a childhood friend had tried to skin her in business, and she decided she didn't have to get up a laugh. Anyway, her mother-in-law went on, he may not have had any much sense of humor about going into the Navy, but he really enjoyed it once he got in. He must have, because he never wrote any homesick letters. He didn't ever write at all. Home never meant anything to him like it did to Cordell. Cordell always had more plans anyway. Dad and I helped him. We helped him buy all that lake frontage and that resort in Wisconsin that you were so set on having. I never heard of any Wisconsin resort, Mary said. I'm tired of people lying to me, Mrs. Graving said. First that manager, Dolly, and now you. We paid all your doctor bills, too, all them bills, and there was never anything the matter with you that I could see. I never had any doctoring bills, Mary said. I never went to a doctor, except when the children came. You're probably thinking of Cordell's ulcer treatment. I gave my son, Mrs. Graving said conclusively. Outside the glass doors of the Vision Avenue apartments, Mrs. Blatke and Greg Z. Hansen, who had once been a Faith Lutheran Church Release Time student of Mary's, were shouting at each other on the sidewalk. Mr. Dolly, the building manager, stood by wringing his hands. An interested circle of elderly residents had gathered. They murmured, oh, and goodness, from time to time. Oh, hi, Mrs. Graving, Gregsy said, breaking off. Oh, so it's hi, Mrs. Graving, is it? Mrs. Blackie screeched. But when I want to park my car in the parking place, he won't move his damned bike. Well, I'm asking you, Mrs. Graving, since he seems to like you so much, who is that boy? I'm calling the police. Yeah, and I won't tell you, Mary heard herself saying. You're going to take up for some kid who busted one of my headlights, are you? You're going to take up for some kid against me? Mary said to herself, I might as well get into a fight as not. I really might as well. He's a friend of mine, she said aloud. Then she said, you owe him an apology, too. She watched the woman's wrath with satisfaction. Apology? Apology? Me apologize to that crummy kid? You threw his bike down on the sidewalk, Mary said. I saw you. Well, did you see what he'd done to my car? It was bad. Gregsie Hansen or somebody had thrown a stone right into the left front headlight. For some reason, from pure force and accuracy, probably, the stone was still stuck in the shiny reflector of the light. You tell me that kid's name or I'll call the police, cried Mrs. Blatke. They'll make you tell. They won't make me do anything, Mary said. Suddenly she felt very hungover. She said, maybe your other headlight will get busted by somebody. Ladies, ladies, cried Mr. Dolly, grasping one earlobe desperately. Please, I've called the police. They'll be here. Please, please, here they come now. It was Merle Schaefer. Mrs. Blatke ran over to his police car and shouted that Mrs. Grabbing had just threatened to break one of her headlights and that kid had already busted the other one. What kid is that, then? Merle inquired, getting out of the car languidly. The three of them turned and saw Gregsie Hansen now pedaling up Vision Avenue away from them and throwing rolled-up copies of the Duluth Herald at doorways as he went. And anyway, she's crazy, Mrs. Blatke shouted, pointing at Mary. I know she's crazy because she goes and visits them people at the Lutheran Social Service on Thursdays. Everybody's seen her. Merle looked at Mary thoughtfully, and then he turned to Mrs. Blatke. Funny, I already told you just today, he said. You don't call a policeman, remember? You forget awful quick, Mrs. Blatke. Now you listen to me. When you get home this afternoon, you see a big ape there, two stories high, and this big ape climbs in your living room window and swipes your TV, and then it goes in your refrigerator and eats everything you got there, including the ice cubes. You don't call a cop. You understand that now? You will get me in trouble yet. Mr. Dolly now held his hands in a position exactly like the framed praying hands picture that hung in his office. I think we can all go back in now, he said in a high, gentle voice. I think the show is over, and he giggled. Nobody who came to the Faith Lutheran Church to see a counselor or therapist on Thursdays parked their car in the church parking lot. They parked across the street by the hospital at the visitor sign and then walked over to the church. It didn't do any good. Everybody knew exactly who had nerves and who was crazy in Rachel River. It didn't matter about the wives of Duluth Air Base personnel. No one cared if they were crazy or not. But everyone knew exactly who the others were. Anyone who used the visiting psychotherapeutic services offered once a week by Lutheran Social Service was crazy or nervous. If they had a decent job, they had nerves. If they were on welfare, they were crazy. Mary Grabbing was just nerves, they guessed. Now Mary sat facing north in the Sunday school room where she had taught release time religion years before. The window faced the forest, where there were still wild animals living. One spring, 20 years or more ago, when men who had come back from one war or another still felt purposeful when they were gathered in groups, someone in town had spread it around that you would get a bounty if you went into those woods and brought out two foxes' feet. All that summer, people killed foxes. There was near and distant firing almost every day, and traps set everywhere. Men referred to the animals, as people always do for some reason when they intend to kill a lot of them, in the collective. There's a lot of fox in there, they remarked to each other on Main Street. A lot of fox and some bear, but not so much bear as fox. Instead of saying, a lot of foxes and some bears. I want to tell you something, Mary said to Jack, the therapist she saw every Thursday. But before I tell you that, thinking of bears out there reminds me of something else I'll tell you. She told the therapist about the young man baking bread in ye olde 61. She described his strong elbows and his arms and how they smelled of whole wheat flour and how he braced them strongly on the table so they were next to her face while they all looked out the window at a bear. She told how she had sat there talking business with the other man, and this man had come and leaned over her table, and how all of a sudden there was this tremendous, irresponsible, unaccountable, absolutely unforeseeable desire all because of this man leaning over her while they looked at the bear. She told Jack how they all looked at the bear, which wasn't really that interesting. But they quit talking and watched it, and then suddenly this man with his arms covered with bread dough, a man whose name she didn't even know, said, "Do you see how when a bear moves it is more like dancing than when a dog moves?" "Well," Mary said now, "well," when he said that, "well," the way he said it, "well," she went out explaining, failing to explain it. "That part about the bear," she said at last, "that dancing, that finished me off." They both laughed, but then the therapist waited, deliberately making a pause too serious to be filled with conversation about bears. "Well, and then I lied to you last week," Mary said, "and this is what I am celebrating. I told you I would not commit suicide because of the children. That is not the reason I won't commit suicide. I was wrong. I won't do it because of this thing I'm celebrating. You see, I thought all life was of the creature, life of the body, and I felt I am dead in my body, yet I am not dead. So therefore, I thought I would do a test. I would see if life is all life of the body or not. So I took nearly all the week and went back over in my memory all the body life I had ever had. I went back over how it was with every man I could remember. Well, at least, every time I could remember." This explanation seemed grandiose, because Mary became anxious because she knew that patients waste half the time in sexual bragging. So she said, "I went over some of the times anyway, and I made myself remember everything, just as if it were now. I went through the births of the children all over again, exactly as if it were happening now. I remembered every detail of the labor and the delivery, and oh, after the delivery of both children, and of beginning to nurse them in the hospital and singing to them, 'Annie Laurie,' I sang, not the first verse, which is dumb, but the other two. Remembering to sing very quietly, because you can tell a baby's ears are not yet spoiled by bad sounds. You can tell that by nearly mashed, delicate-looking way the ear lies close to their heads. The way they lie mashed back against their heads like that, you can tell they have only heard the most wonderful sounds, like sounds from underwater. So I went back over all of that, and it was awfully sad. My God, it was sad. But it was not what I was grieving for. It wasn't. I felt sorry for myself and for everyone else in the meantime, because if it is physical delights we live for, we certainly don't get to spend our time in very nice places. We are always working in the basement, or drinking in the VFW, or washing things at the laundromat. The rich are the only ones that sail on beautiful lakes, and they call that touching down on reality. Just yesterday, someone told me sailing was touching down on reality, and all the while he was skinning me clean in a wholesale offer. Suddenly I realized I wasn't staying alive for my children. I was staying alive for something I haven't even begun to do yet. So I stopped being altruistic as if I were some saint giving myself up for others. And I stopped thinking my life would be so different if only I could live in a cultivated place. Why do we praise children when they are willing to go into museums? So culture is nothing. I found out this week, nothing. It isn't why we live. And animal life, all that body stuff, that isn't it either. It is something yet to do, something we're supposed to be doing in the future. But that's as far as I've got. I haven't looked at it any closer. I was simply so excited that I wasn't going to die and that animal life is not all there is, that I went to the VFW lounge to get drunk and celebrate. And in there, I listened to the men talking. They're in worse shape than I am, even. They thought World War II was sort of a suit of armor, and now they don't know what they ought to be doing. Do you know that whenever I mention World War II on my radio program, 5 or 10 of them in this one little town alone call me up and tell me things from their lives? And yet I had a terrible day yesterday because I didn't know what life will be, and animal life has been taken away. And then even the new life, my life of thinking about suicide, was taken away. I was so empty then. I was horribly empty. So I got into a coarse street quarrel with a woman over a little boy. When he called me up later and said, "Thank you for standing up for me," it was as if somebody who was not anybody had stood up for him. I was simply emptied. But this week, Jack said, what about the suicide? It's gone, Mary said. But do you know, I used to make special toys for the children. I still do. I am making a bookcase with a secret compartment. When I was sewing for them or building something, I used to think, well then, this is life. And I was wrong about that, too. Life for others isn't anything either. Just as the rich are mistaken in thinking that there is reality in sailing, the rest of us are mistaken in thinking there is reality in carpentry. So I think it is something we have to keep an eye out for, what we're supposed to do, why to stay alive. Do you sail ever? Well, if you know small boats, you know about keeping an eye out for the darker places on the water to windward, because the darker place, which keeps getting close, is what tells you how to trim differently. Well, that's enough. She stopped. Her facial tic reappeared now, and she controlled it. But it is wonderful, wonderful, she said, to come here and tell you depressing stuff. Every day I am cheerful on the radio, and people come up to me and Ben Franklin and say, oh, you cheer us up so on the radio, and my friends who are happily married come up and say, you do a terrific job of taking on that toy business so cheerfully. We must be living in the most cheerful-minded century in the history of the world, even though the sheriff says the whole race is uniquely filthy. Mary and the therapist both laughed, and then they did serious work for the remainder of the session. She was not allowed then to divert from the serious work by telling stories about coarse women or any of the other supposed facts of her life. Do you like her as a character? Do you like her as a person? What did you make of the laundromat episode?
Just some things I would like to do and don't have the nerve to do.
You would have liked to do that in the laundromat?
Oh, I would like to dump a box of cheer over her head. But yeah, like that would have been fun to do.
It would have been very uncharitable. This poor woman is recovering from the suicide death of her husband.
I know. She was nasty.
She was nasty.
Yeah. But she did, and then she did what I would do too. Then she apologized.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting because those two women did sort of go at each other. They were both in a bad mood. They were both suffering.
That was better than this pretending that being cheerful. To me, it was a lot more touching reality.
Well, there was a kind of almost a point at which they had something in common there. I mean, in spite of all their negative feelings about the other. There was a moment in which there was almost a coming together, but then it was quickly over with another insult about the police. It must be for you because it couldn't possibly be for me. That was wonderful.
But you're right. I mean, they did. There was some connection that.
Yeah.
There was a moment of sympathy between them. One had lost her husband from divorce and the other from suicide. And they were both struggling and they were both in a laundromat, which isn't very much fun.
Ingrid, partly the story's about, I think, the tension between living in the past and looking ahead. There's an awful lot of dwelling on World War II and its meaning for people today. The Gold Star Mother, the veterans who call in whenever she does something about from that period, and there were several references to.
And Merle, who walks around with all his women clinging to him.
Yeah. and yet I think Mary at least wants to live into the future, not in the past. There's that going on.
And she had it in her mind that the idea to live, the reason to live was for physical pleasure. And then that wasn't working for her.
No, that wasn't it.
And then working, you live in service to others, to your children. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't doing it for her either.
But then isn't there a hint at the end that there's a reason to live for something you don't know yet what it is?
Yeah.
But it'll come, so stay alive to see what it is.
Yeah. Which I thought was an interesting decision. Or direct
curiosity takes over.
Curiosity.
Yeah.
I'd really like to have a sequel. I got very interested in her.
Yeah.
There's a lot of denial in it, by the way, some of the characters of reality, like the mother and mom.
It was interesting to me that the stories within the stories, the one story was about the painting over the mantle, and the story that the children and Mary made up about that was that the boat sailed away and left the person falling overboard, watching the boat get smaller and smaller in the distance. And the other story within a story was, what was it? Does anybody remember?
Son lied to his mother to get money from her.
The son lied to the mother to get, that's right, there was that lying business. But there was another actual story that they told.
St. Alban?
Oh, yeah, it was St. Alban.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then the man in their town that had been saved in World War II. So, Mary, I mean, it was sort of like that character on Saturday on that program about Alaska that's filmed in Seattle.
Northern Exposure.
It's like the guy on the radio there. You know, he spouts out wisdom. And she was doing this thing with St. Alban that I thought was sort of her wisdom to the community. Come on, folks, you know, we should think about giving ourselves in for others. So there was this whole theme, I think, that was played out through there of self-sacrifice. And I mean, St. Alban was killed, and so was, or could have been, this person in World War II.
But after telling that story, she decides that sacrificing her life for her kids is not the answer either.
Right.
That's kind of an interesting parallel. Well, I give that up, I'm just saying.
The story keeps asking the question about what it's life about.
Right. The story keeps asking the question, what's life about?
Brother Emmett gave up his life for Cordell, too, because he was more or less asked by his parents to volunteer, so they wouldn't, by chance, drag Cordell, because Cordell was more loving than Emmett.
Why do you think Emmett never wrote home?
I wonder if Emmett just left.
Why was it called? Who was the Gold Star mother?
The mother-in-law.
The mother-in-law.
And Emmett's the reason.
Right. So she got to be the Gold Star mother because this kid was killed in the war, we think.
She doesn't have very fond memories of Emmett.
Right, and he probably never wrote him because he was dead. And the Gold Star mother, in actual fact, here, I mean, this woman did not have Mary, did not have a moment to her name, her name. I mean, she was doing her carpentry, she did the laundry, she did business appointments, she took a look after the kids, she cooked dinner, which was her hobby. Her day was so packed. I mean, she was poor. She didn't have enough money.
And a daily radio program.
Can you imagine? She gets, I figured it out, $25 for every one of those programs.
Yeah.
She has to come up with 20 minutes every day on that town for $25. So she's got to be hustling around trying to find out what's going on in the town. She worked very hard. So there's a sense in which she is a Gold Star mother. Because we see her just constantly struggling to keep this thing going, you know, and she, we added up all her income for the year, and it wasn't enough, 11,000, whatever.
I thought one of the interesting segments was in talking to the mother-in-law. We, and she apparently finds out some more evidence against this rotten husband.
Cordell, right.
Yeah, and, you know, and the mother-in-law never acknowledges that there might be a discrepancy in the story. I mean, just assumes that what Cordell told her was right.
Right. And then she says, the mother-in-law's last line is, I gave my son. And we don't even know which son she's, I mean.
Which one?
Yeah.
And Cordell's, she's predicting his future behavior with regard to child payments. 11 months, then 10 months, probably an average of 8 months.
8 months. For another year.
Yeah.
It's right. Well, you know, you wonder why she stayed in touch with her mother-in-law at all. She was not charming.
No. Small town, there's nothing you can do about it.
But she actually saw her out, didn't she? I don't remember how they...
Well, she just went...